second of tonight's speakers, Kenny.
I'm Shelley.
My name's Kenny, I'm an addict. I have microphones. I can hold it. It's kind of weird talking into it. I can kind of hear it out of there. This ain't working, is it? Is it me? It is working. This is really me. Hello, hello. That's better. That's better. Monitor. I was listening to the previous speaker, and I thought, you know, family systems, they get you every time, don't they? Mum was quite all right. I've got levels of denial, of course, but it seemed all right. Looking back and through exploration of some of the gear that went down, it's surreal how it can affect you. When I grew up in this family, I was... my father was the oldest of all his brothers. My mother was the oldest of, well, there's two of them, her and her sister. And I was born, so I was the first grandchild of the kind of elder siblings and all that. I was blonde-haired, I was blue-eyed, born into this, like, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, poverty-stricken family that was riddled with alcoholism. And I was the great white hope. I was going to save the family for the purgatory it was going through. And I kind of didn't know that at the time, of course. I was a baby. But I always felt it, but I couldn't kind of put words to it. So I'm growing up, and I'm all right. I really am okay. I was outgoing. I was gregarious. Found it really easy to make friends, still do. Very popular at school. This is good CV, isn't it? Really creative, really spontaneous, was into things, was bright, but the whole, you know, it felt fantastic. It really felt, and I can't connect with it too much now because all the anxiety's in the way, but I'm hoping I'll come off the ceiling at about 10-2. But when I can remember that feeling when I was a small child thinking, I can do anything, I can achieve anything. You know, it felt like the family I was in, the extended family, there was a lot of love, there was a lot of security and a lot of warmth. That's how it felt. That's how it felt. Anything is possible. And it kind of didn't turn out like that. I remember when I was thinking of pivotal moments. There's been a few. There's been loads, actually. I've got about 15 sub-personalities in my head, all vying to get a bit of airtime now. And what happened, I was 11 years of age, and I just wanted to be a part of. I've got this need to be a bit part of, really. I don't think it's, you know, to do with addiction. I think it's just part of the human condition. I know we can overblow it at times. And I need, you know, it's just how it is. So I just wanted to be a part of what my mates were doing, you know, smashing windows and going football and having skinhead haircuts and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I've gone off and had a skinhead haircut, number one. And I've got white hair, so it's looked like I'm bald at this point, because you can, it's really, it's like downy hair, you know. And I've gone home, my old man's looked at me, and I just see his face. And I thought, oh, right, I thought I'm one of the boys now. Is it now that I asked for the Dr. Martins? It doesn't seem like it's a good time. This just took me round to my nan's, and she has ironed me right out. I'm 11. She's ironed me right out. People like that, they go to jail, they go to concentration camps, people with haircuts like that, and I'm 11. It's absolutely smashed me. And that is my first recollection of being introduced to shame. And that's when I know that's kind of, there's unwritten rules in this family that you need to abide by. It weren't told to me what I could and I couldn't do. I thought I was free, and I weren't. And I guess unconsciously what I did was brought so much shame on that family. You don't want to fuck about with shame, I'll show you shame. And I went off on a kind of 20-year bender, really. I mean, I love drugs. The feeling that they evoke in me, I like all that. I went through my school days. I got bored at about 13, really. Really boring. Didn't want to sit in lessons and all that. Wanted to smoke snout and, you know, do all that stuff. And so as I'm growing up, I went through school and I started to use substances. And I remember the first time I got paralytic. It was on New Year's Eve, 1975. Round my mate's house, all nicking the drinks out of the drinks cabinet because his mum and dad were out. And I remember laying in the garden with everything spinning round and thinking, this is fantastic. No adults, no one from the culture that spawned me thought it was a bad thing. It was like a rites of passage experience on your way to manhood, really. So, you know, I'd come along with smoking snout and getting nicked and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it. I loved the feeling. It was fantastic. So through my teens, I kind of got into using substances, and I really liked it. It was part of, you know, going football, getting drunk, smoking snout, smoking spliffs, taking LSD. All that, I was experimenting with stuff. I wanted to get high. I wanted to get away from myself. I just felt so out of my depth. I couldn't talk about how I felt. It didn't really feel that I could achieve what I wanted no more. And at the age of 20, I went out committing crime. I'm not a career criminal, I never was. I usually like jump on the coattails of other people, that kind of stuff. So he went and done a bit of work. And got nicked, got arrested, because I'm not good at that, because I don't know what I'm doing. And my dad come up, put down surety, and got me back into London, give me the third degree about the people I'm having it with, and all that kind of stuff. And I went to bed, and I was awoke in the morning by a knock on the door, and I've answered the door, and there's a guy in a white coat. He says, "Your dad has collapsed at work." And I kind of knew. I knew at that point. And I went and got my mum. She was at work, and I got my mum. It'd be all right. And I knew it wasn't going to be all right. I knew this was it. And he was on the life support machine for about a month. And where he'd been out so long, the oxygen had got to his brain. And even if he survived outside of that oxygen machine, that was it. He was brain dead. So me and my mother had to give the decision to turn this machine off. I was 20, and I was a child. And they turned it off 36 hours later, and my dad died. And what happened to me, what message I gave myself, what I took from that situation was, you just killed your old man. If you wouldn't have got near to put him through that stress and dragged him through that, he'd still be alive. And I couldn't cope with that. He was my world. I mean, as a kid, you know, when my dad goes to the toilet, I just used to sit outside the door waiting for him. I followed him around everywhere. And that was it. My kind of use of substances, the kind of substances I took, really changed. I didn't want to feel great and all that. I didn't want to feel anything. I went into feelings. I didn't want to do that stuff. So I took substances that killed all feelings. Put me unconscious for as long as possible, really. And when I come back conscious again, repeat it, keep doing it. I couldn't do it. What I then did, really, was just be really abusive towards my mother, really put her through it, take every penny off her that she's got, invite people to live in her house with me, sell drugs, commit petty crime, become a punt, do all those sort of things really. And was just really angry, really, really angry. And I didn't see no way out. I mean, all the beauty in this world, everything that's possible, my aspirations, all my dreams, that not only that I had, that my family had for me, they were all gone. It was all dark now. And I felt totally isolated. I felt totally different. And I just wanted to be unconscious. And I kind of can remember that. Waking up in the morning at about 5:30 because your body's woke you up because it needs drugs, and feeling like you just can't do it anymore, but there's no way out and you have to. You have to. There was a lot of consequences for me, for my family. I mean, when I went into rehab, I left 2 using addicts living at my mother's house. I invited one to live, she was a clipper, she was fantastic at earning money. I mean, and all my earning days were gone, all the houses and all that, and the selling gear, and all that was gone, man. I was a bit successful then, and I weren't. I was really, really skinny, so when you're going out robbing and trying to nick generators, I can't pick generators. I remember it was over the island one day, there was a geezer down a manor, and he's got the generator, so he just unclear it, grab the generator, run around the car, put it in, great, 100 quid straight away done, you know, that sorted out the day. And I just remember grabbing it, I couldn't pick it up, and I'm dragging it along on the Isle of Dogs in the geezer because the lights come out, he's coming up, he's seeming, and I'm dragging it. And I leave it and take off, get on the car, just. And, couldn't fend for myself, couldn't do it. By this time, I'm injecting. My attempt at building home was a flat, a mattress on the floor. This is how it started out. It didn't even start out great. It started out with buying a mattress and sticking it on the floor. Rolls of carpet down the side of the front room that never got unfurled. The cooker in the kitchen that never got plugged in. Never put electric on because it's an expense I can do without. And if you want to hit, you've got to go on the stairwells because that's where the lights are. So I lived like that for a while. And I used to be into books and poetry and music, and I was smashed. I didn't have no interests. I couldn't watch film no more. I couldn't feel good. I couldn't do that stuff. And I kind of believed the lie. You know, once an addict and that's it, and you know, go and find yourself a shallow grave and then just get in it, and that's you now. And it weren't true, and it ain't true, and I thought it was. And cut a long story short, some local authority had the wit to go and give me a few quid and put me through a rehab, and I got in there, and I got clean. I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, and the second one's the most important. And I didn't realise it then. They used to force me into these H&I meetings. It felt like a gunpoint to go and listen to these people with strange accents. And I thought, I can't do this. What are they on about? And I was trying to really help me. I didn't know that kind of gear. But I come out of there with a girlfriend. We had the same birthday, so it's meant to be. She's the first woman who looked at me in at least 10 years. Marry her. Don't let her escape. We had all the fantasies going on out here, down me back. She thought I was Axl Rose. I didn't think I was Axl Rose. I thought I was someone else. David Bowie, I think. She had jet black hair, so she was my Indian squaw, and we was off and running. That was it. And I'll tell you what, that was one of the best things that happened to me in my first year. It kind of kept me going for a while, because it just got my esteem up. It was like, oh, wow. I forgot what that even felt like. It was fantastic. It was quite intense, isn't it? Short-lived, burnt out really quickly. She used. How dare she? But she used speed, and that one might drag us for us half. I lived with it for a while. And then she said, we've got to detach. She said, has anyone ever heard that one? Oh, no! I'm leaving you, again, use and go back to my boyfriend. That's where it really meant. So anyway, so I kind of laid in the dry ass and played love songs for about 3 months. Welcome, and I'll quote some on this kid. Keep coming back, it's better. By that time, I was in the fellowship. I'd come out of this facility, landed in this small town in Somerset. They had donkeys, a beach and a pier. And all washed up in a dry house. Talking out the side of my neck. Scared. Really, really scared. In a lot of pain. Very scared. Yeah. And I was in this fellowship, and this scared me more than anything. I mean, I'd be outside, hear him share, what did, and all that gear. But when it happened in here, when people were getting honest, I just shrunk. I couldn't even talk. I didn't open my mouth in this fellowship 10 months. Once, I think, in the first 11 months. Couldn't do it. I just knew intuitively, if I did, I'd melt. I just knew it, I'd just become a puddle. But kind of, there was something in it that kept me coming here. I think it was I didn't have a plan B, really. But I think it was something else. I kept coming here. I got put up for commitments. Oh my God, GSR community, I put again a year, I said, and you voted in, you're like, I've got no worth at this point to say, actually, I don't know what that means, I don't know if I want to do that. Do you want to do it? I can't even say yes or no, that's it. Now you've got to go to a thing called an ASC. I couldn't even talk. They sent me to get key rings, I come back without them. Service, man. So I started to get involved. I got a sponsor. I asked if I wanted to be. Will you be my temporary sponsor? He said, it's got to be a back door. And he said yes. So brilliant. 45 minutes later, after I've given all this relationship here, it's just okay. I picked a sponsor who didn't have a phone. I thought he was cool then, and I still think he's cool. Now, class is that? You got a phone? No. What happened was we decided to meet 2 o'clock every Sunday at the same place, and there was a meeting at 3 o'clock. So we'd meet up, we'd spend an hour, and then we'd go and do the meeting. And I kind of started to build up a relationship with this fella. And I'd take huge, monumental risks. Like, I felt quite sad yesterday, I'd say. Which felt huge for me. And I'd go, okay, I think that went down all right. Felt quite big for me. It's kind of just rolled with that really easily. But what was happening, I was seeing if this was all right. It's all right us sitting in meetings and you're going, yeah, read this book, and doesn't that sound great? But that's not good enough for me. I kind of need the connection, kind of, the innate drive in me, just new intuitive, I need this connection. And I started to build a relationship up with this guy. I'm doing service, I'm on a convention committee meeting as well. I think a few of you might have done convention committee meetings. I was 8 months clean, couldn't talk. And in these kind of meetings, they was something else. So I'm doing this stuff. He suggested a few things. Let's start working steps. I'd already done the steps in Trip London, fucking inside out, working steps. He suggested I do service and kind of started doing this, continue to go meetings and I started doing steps with him. And pivotal moment was doing the step 4 and 5. I was carrying gear. I know what I use. I know the stuff that triggers me. I know my shame. I know what it is. and I've always known what it is. So my first kind of step four and step five was just going, never told anyone that, bang, and seeing how it went down. It was all right. It's kind of all right. It was unexpectedly all right. I think that point, and I can remember the room, and I can remember it was my front room. It was in a place called Clifton Road. There was a sex shop on the corner, and my first flat in recovery, that's quite a corner, wasn't it? I can remember it, bang, and just that feeling of what happens now. What happens now? This is my greatest fear. I've just told you about myself. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to receive it? How are you going to receive me? Am I okay? Tell me I'm okay. And I was kind of given love and acceptance, which is what I seek now. I still seek love now, and I want more self-acceptance. That's what I want. And I was kind of given that through another member of this fellowship. And not only did it give me faith, not only did it give me hope, it kind of started to restore my faith in the human race. Because at this point I was just totally alienated from the whole of the human race and everything that's on offer. I started doing stuff like getting into college. Getting qualifications. Getting in a relationship, getting your heart broke again, not using, getting a full-time job, having to pay bills. When how I was living, I was on more money because of cash in hand and stuff like that. And if I took this full-time employment, I'm going to be much worse off financially. And doing it because I knew, I'm working towards something here. It's not a financial decision. This is not a financial decision. And taking that risk and living with it. But the most important thing that I started to build up in this fellowship was connections with you. I mean, I invested really wisely when I got in. I invested in you. That's what I invested in. And it became about the connections I had with people. But my core issues are sexual in their nature, and when they come out in a step four, there was, you know, as I said, I just released it at that point, and it was like, oh, now someone else knows. Not only does someone else know, someone else is now part of the healing process. And I got to a point in my recovery, and my sponsor said, you need to take this on the road and open it up to other people. And I did. And it was, I was inviting people in, like, I need help, please help me, I can't do this. This stuff is destroying me inside. And I come into the fellowship to get it. I didn't go to social services. I certainly didn't go to my family. Do you know what I mean? I didn't get out of books. I come to you. And it's more than enough. It's more than enough. And what started to happen was I kind of started to smile and laugh and do stuff like, I'm going to go on holiday. What a novel concept. Started to do stuff, love football, started to go football again, you know, started to get back into film, started to get back into music, you know, I started to connect with myself and what I really liked and what I really loved and what my passions were. Life was alright, life was okay, life was alright. I continued to work through the steps. Step nine seemed huge. I mean, the most painful one for me was step eight. It was particularly out of green and gold, where it asked all of us, but I was doing it as my step eight. It asked me, be specific, why this person's on your list. So I ain't just putting a name on it, it was the cataloguing and the guilt, what I'd done to my mother. There was pages and pages on it. I mean, I've committed crimes, I've done this and all that, and if I'm really honest, you've got any guilt around it? Not really, no. But that stuff just so affected me. And making amends for it, every birthday, buy himself, buy your mother something. Make sure you phone her on her birthday. Send her a card on Mother's Day. Always tell her you love her when you phone her. That kind of stuff. And when I used to go, because I was living in the West Country, when I used to go back to London to see my mother, she was just so proud of me. I mean, I'm an only child. I was her only son. She thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to die. And and then she did die. I was at a World Convention in Hawaii. And I got the news that my mother had died. And I remember walking into her. And then I've never felt pain like that. I thought when my old man died, I thought that's pain. I thought that's pain. When my mother died, I remember getting a phone call. I was in an hotel room and my body sunk, my shoulders. I couldn't stand up properly because of the weight of it. And I remember getting out onto the street and going into the Pacific Ocean and just trying to, and I just couldn't hold up. I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't. And I went to this meeting. I just hung on for this meeting in Honolulu. And I walked into this meeting in America. And went in there and just cried like a baby. Cried like a baby. And I remember this black American woman shared straight after me. And she said, I'd like to tell you it's going to be okay. But it's not. It's going to really hurt. Do you know what? That's what I needed to hear. Don't tell me it's all going to be okay and you get through. Don't. It's too delicate and sensitive right now. Just tell me the truth. And she did. And I remember walking out of the meeting, and these people, I don't know. I've never seen them in my life, and I possibly will never. You know, as I'm walking out, you hang in there, man. And it was like, I can do this. I can. I've got to. I can't afford not to. What are my options? And I got back from there and I wanted to use every day for about 6 weeks. And when I get into pain, my head goes into painkillers. I know, but it always killed pain, it always will. It's a painkiller, that's what it does. And I didn't. And tough times. 2005, what a great year for me. New girlfriend, new job, new flat, brilliant. West Ham, we just got into the playoffs and got the Premiership. It was just, can it get any better than this? End of the year, my mum was dead, my girlfriend was gone, my nan was dead. And it's kind of life on life's terms. It's life on life's terms. No one said to me, I'm exempt from feeling tragedy. No one told me that you know everything's going to be great. And I kind of just floated along for a while. Just coming to meetings, writing out steps, talking to my sponsor, connecting with people, still taking on sponsees, and just getting plugged in because I know this works. It ain't theory for me, it's my experience. I know it works. I mean, if it didn't work, I wouldn't come here, I'm mad. That's not true, really. I am not. But, it's kind of. I think my point's established. But the flip side of that is. Kind of feel alive. I've kind of been cut off from myself for a long time through the shame I felt in my childhood, through the shame of my using aspects of myself that I kind of abandoned myself and don't acknowledge parts of myself and all. And it's over the last 3 years where that's kind of, I'm just thawing out. I don't feel so trapped. I'm laughing a lot more. Laughter's brilliant. I love laughter. It's fantastic. It's free, you can do it any time you want. Not like most things. And it makes me feel good. And I never used to laugh. I was saying to Mickey earlier, I like choosing to live in like depression and anxiety. There's a lot of gravity to that stuff. It's deep, isn't it? Yeah. But what I'm learning, like, it's just, I'm really enjoying laughing. I mean, I kind of got to a point in my recovery. I was 10 years clean. I'm in this town. They've still got donkeys, etc. And I just feel like I come to the end of myself. I just wanted to come home. And, so I did. I secured a job. Didn't have nowhere to live. My aunt went, you can come and live with me. As long as you like. Don't have to rush into anything. You can come back. This is a person who wouldn't have me in her house. Put all my stuff in my ex's garage, there you go, jumped in my car with my clothes and just come back to London, start again. New fellowship, new fellowship. It's the same process. I've got a new sponsor. I started working steps with that sponsor. This time around, it weren't nothing to do with using. It's all my behaviour in recovery. It's around sex, it was around intimacy, it was around food, it was around everything about drugs. And I'm engaging with his sponsor. Started to get service commitments, started to do service, taking on a few more sponsors in London, and just plugging into this fellowship. And This is where the love is. I mean, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in a higher power. I don't believe in any of that. But I wholeheartedly have to access a power greater. Have to have that. And it comes primarily through you. Because what I do believe in is love. I believe in the love you show me. I believe in the love that my friends give me, my godchildren. I believe in that. That's tangible. That's real. I feel that. That's what I believe in. And I need to maintain that and keep that going. That's the power. That's what I believe in. And I come here and that's what I do. That's what I do. And I just kind of keep it going. I'm having a bit of an NA loving at the moment, which is quite rare. And it's kind of nice, and I want it to last forever, but it won't. My experience is joy while you can, it don't last forever. But I'm really enjoying the fellowship. I'm really enjoying what I get out of it. I've done a step 4 and 5 last year. Another really scary one, nowhere near the first one. It's not so much about an individual no more. Can I trust this one person, this individual, this one person here? It's like I trust this process. I just trust the process. I kind of know. Throughout the course of the years, I've been clean. I'm kind of quite adept at going to the right address now. There's a lot of right addresses, and there's even more wrong addresses. And I've been to a few wrong addresses. And you knock at the door, and it goes, John. They go, no, John, don't live here, mate. You go, okay. You give it 10 minutes. You go back, knock at the same door, same geezer. I says, John, no, there's the wrong address. I ain't gonna get my need met there. John ain't there. Don't live there. He's never been there. I've never heard of John. But I'm kind of quite adept to going to the right address now, and it don't take me that long. If something's going on. If something's happening, I'll just get on the phone. I'll go to the exact notes really quick. All right, you've got 5 minutes, yeah. Bam. Because I've got that kind of relationship with a lot of people, where I can do that. If my sponsor's busy, if he's on holiday, it's okay. I've done step fives with quite a few people. It's not one person no more. It's just... And I feel part of the human race. It feels like I'm engaging in life. I mean, last year was fantastic. What a big year it was for me. This one's even better so far. I mean, where can we go with this gear? We can go anywhere with this. I mean, I've been abroad twice already. I'm going to Brazil this month. Brazil. I couldn't even get out of the bedroom. And if I did, I was knocking on your door asking, you got any filters? I'm going to Brazil, mate. And it's given me a fantastic life. I mean, I'm trying to branch out in my work and get into a bit of private practice. I want to expand my skills. I want to see what I can actually achieve, because I come from a place where it's crumbs from the table and play it really safe, and you got this job and you stay there. And if you could see where we can go with this, Ken. Can't believe I said that. Yeah, let's see where we can go with it. What's the worst thing that can happen? All right, you top up skin and you ain't got nowhere to live. It's never going to happen that I've got nowhere to live. Well, so much love to show me, it's never going to happen. And that's my fear. I'll be skin, you get nowhere to live. It's never going to happen. So I'm kind of, is this an actual phrase? Does this work? I'm tentatively taking risks. Kind of contradiction in terms, but yeah, it's there, yeah, and kind of feel extremely hopeful at this point in my recovery. I can't, you know, when you get that nervous, what could it be? Could this happen for you? Even you, and it's like, yeah, it is happening. It's happening now. This is beyond my wildest dreams. I couldn't have thought this up. You know when you get in, I don't know if you know, but when I got in the rear, they give you think, write down what you want to achieve. It's like, I'm going to put stuff like that down. I feel good about myself some of the time. I actually inhabit my body some of the time. I come from a place of shame. I can't afford to inhabit my body. I've got body shame. I've got all sorts of neurosis going on. I inhabit my body some of the time. That's huge for me. Yes, yeah, it's massive. I haven't got the words. And I'm experiencing more of it now. So I don't know where I can go with this. I don't know where we can go with this. I mean, this fellowship's just mind-blowing. It's absolutely, it spins my nuts. You know, I go to countries and I go in, you're in some like mad like a state in Copenhagen or something, and you go in and it's an NA meeting. Same key rings, talking in a different language. Show you how to get from the meeting afterwards. It's like, where can you get that? Not only is it free, not only is it loving, it's worldwide. This is on tap if we want it. And I feel really connected to it. This fellowship's given me everything in my life. Everything I've got right now is as a direct result of that. That includes the relationships, my family, the relationships, my friends, everything, the whole thing. I come in a broken man. I'm not broken anymore. I'm recovering. And I knew since the day I got here. It's fantastic to be clean. I mean, I finished work. I had two people let me down today. There's always two, and there's never one. It's always two. I can't turn up. It's like, so I was at a bit of a loose end. I don't like loose end. I like being in control. And I thought, you've had enough coffee today. Don't sit down and have coffee. You've got to share. You'll be going on for 58 minutes or something. Coming out of loads of mad gear, and you won't be able to stop and all that. So I finished my work at Ivory, and I just walked into town, took about an hour and 10 minutes, just, I love London, this is my city, I love this city, and I just walked into town, just walked here, it was just fantastic, what a simple thing, beautiful, and I got here, knew it or not, I see a lot of people I know, and how are you, and a bit of laugh and encouragement and all that, just plug into the love, it's all about the love. It's always about the feelings, and it's always about the love. I'll leave it in place.